Hello, everybody. My name is Pranita Tama, and I'll be discussing the treatment of antimicrobial-resistant infections, including Pseudomonas aeruginosa, Acinetobacter baumannii, and Stenotrophomonas multifilia. And I have no disclosures. So I'll start with highlighting the Infectious Diseases Society of America 2024 guidance on the treatment of antimicrobial resistant gram-negative infections. This document is available online and covers a variety of antimicrobial resistant pathogens and is worth reviewing ahead of the board exam. But I'll focus on three of these pathogens, and I'll start with a clinical case. This is the case of a 12-year-old boy with acute myelogenous leukemia. He's neutropenic, and unfortunately, he developed acute onset fevers, respiratory distress, and as you could see from his CT scan, a pretty prominent pneumonia. Pseudomonas aeruginosa was recovered from bronchoalveolar lavage fluid. And this is the susceptibility pattern. And you could see that the only organ, the only antibiotic without a R or resistance next to it was colistin. And colistin actually has no susceptible category. It only has an intermediate or resistant category. And this is really because it's just not a preferred treatment anymore for any gram-negative organism. And there's multiple reasons for this. The penetration of colistin into the pulmonary epithelial lining fluid is suboptimal, even with dose optimization. And of course, this is a problem with an organism that tends to cause pneumonia, like Pseudomonas aeruginosa. Colistin is administered as an inactive prodrug, and this prodrug is slowly and incompletely converted to colistin. So less than 10% of the prodrug gets converted to the active form. And you could imagine in patients with normal renal function or augmented renal clearance, so increased renal clearance, that the percentage that gets converted is going to be even less. There's many reports of heteroresistance that occur during polymyxin monotherapy, and this is probably because of suboptimal drug concentrations at sites of infection. And there's many new antibiotic trials that use colistin as a comparator, almost all of which show inferior outcomes in the colistin arm. And finally, as we're probably all well aware, a lot of patients, approximately half of patients, develop acute kidney injury receiving colistin. So hopefully I've convinced you that colistin is not a preferred therapy for Pseudomonas aeruginosa or even for other resistant gram-negative infections. And the one exception might be in the for urinary tract infections because it concentrates so well there. So let's talk a little bit about Pseudomonas aeruginosa. Pseudomonas is a fascinating organism because it has this capacity to accumulate a variety of resistance mechanisms. When we see DTR are difficult to treat resistant Pseudomonas, and we'll go through that definition soon, usually these organisms have either a loss or a defect with a porin called OPRD, and this is responsible for carbapenem entry, imipenem over meropenem. These organisms also have increased expression of efflux pumps, and these pumps can pump out a variety of beta-lactams, fluoroquinolones, and even beta-lactamase inhibitors like avibactam of ceftazidime avibactam or relibactam of imipenem relibactam. Very interestingly, these pumps actually don't seem to pump out imipenem. So sometimes when you see a Pseudomonas susceptible to imipenem but not meropenem, it might be that they have overexpression of one of these efflux pumps. There's also a variety of target sites that Pseudomonas can modify, making it hard for antibiotics to kill the bacteria. So they may be able to enter the bacteria, stay in the bacteria, but if the target's altered, they no longer have activity. And finally, Pseudomonas does produce a variety of beta-lactamase enzymes that can hydrolyze both beta-lactams as well as aminoglycosides through specific aminoglycoside-modifying enzymes. Now, unlike the Enterobacterales, where we're worried about carbapenemase enzymes, this is less of a concern with Pseudomonas, at least in the United States. And we'll touch upon this a little later in the presentation. So back to our patient, he has what we would consider DTR are difficult to treat resistance, and this is basically resistance to all traditional beta-lactams, including carbapenems, as well as fluoroquinolones. And the reason that we have this definition is that more than half of the time when you have a carbapenem-resistant Pseudomonas, it still retains activity to some beta-lactam antibiotics. So for example, to cefepime. So DTR basically says we have no traditional beta-lactams or quinolones as treatment options. So fortunately for Pseudomonas aeruginosa, we have a variety of antibiotics that became available in the last several years with activity against DTR Pseudomonas. So let's go through all of these. Now, if we look at a snapshot of how likely these drugs are to be active against Pseudomonas, you'll see that the most likely is sulfitoricol at about 95%. And this is followed by three beta-lactam beta-lactamase inhibitors, including ceftolozane tazobactam, ceftazidime avibactam, and imirelibactam. Hopefully, what I'll convince you after the portion on Pseudomonas is that we really want to test susceptibility to all four of these agents whenever we have a DTR Pseudomonas infection. So let's talk very briefly about sulfitoricol. So our innate immune system minimizes available free iron in response to bacterial infections. Most iron in humans is bound to hemoglobin, myoglobin, or iron-binding proteins. Now, bacteria upregulate the production of their siderophores, which are these iron chelating compounds that scavenge the body for free iron. Sulfitoricol is a cephalosporin antibiotic bound to a siderophore, and basically what it does is it binds to iron, then it sneaks into bacteria into iron transport channels. And once it makes it into the bacteria and gets rid of the iron, and now it can bind to its target, which is penicillin binding protein 3, disrupting cell wall synthesis. So if we were to go purely on which of these four drugs with activity against DTR Pseudomonas is most likely to be active against a Pseudomonas isolate before you have susceptibility results available, the answer would be sulfitoricol. But this doesn't necessarily mean it's the best agent to use. So let's compare outcomes across agents. Unfortunately, we do not have any clinical trials comparing new drugs to each other, and rather we have data from observational studies or subgroup analyses from clinical trials comparing new drug to polymyxins. And for all the beta-lactam, beta-lactamase inhibitors, such as ceftolozane, tazobactam, ceftazidime, avibactam, imipenem, relibactam, they performed better than the polymyxins. And hopefully I've convinced you already that the polymyxins are really not optimal agents to be using. Unfortunately, even though sulfitoricol is much more likely to be active compared to these other drugs against DTR Pseudomonas, its performance based on available clinical trials shows that its activity seems to be just as good as the polymyxins in improving patient outcomes. And this is why the IDSA guidance considers the three beta-lactam beta-lactamase inhibitors, ceftolozane tazobactam, ceftazidime avibactam, and imipenem-relibactam as preferred treatment for DTR Pseudomonas and sulfitoricol as an alternative. Another interesting concept to think about with these drugs is the emergence of resistance. So if you were to prescribe these drugs for a DTR Pseudomonas, the next time the patient has a DTR Pseudomonas, what is the likelihood that these agents will remain active? So I wanted to share one experience that highlights some of the concerns. This was a report of 28 consecutive patients with DTR Pseudomonas, with all isolates susceptible to ceftolozane tazobactam. They received at least 72 hours of treatment with this agent, and Pseudomonas isolates were available before and after ceftolozane tazobactam exposure. And the before and after isolates were tested by broth microdilution for MICs, and whole genome sequencing was performed to make sure that the before and after isolates from the same patients were genetically related. And what was surprising was for 14 of the 28 patients, so for half the patients, the next time they had Pseudomonas aeruginosa isolated within the next 30 days, the isolate was no longer susceptible to ceftolozane tazobactam. And remarkably, a lot of these isolates also now became resistant to ceftazidime avibactam, and about a quarter had increases in their MICs to cefiderocol. This basically highlights that because three of these four drugs are cephalosporin-based, there's a lot of structural similarities between them. And when resistance develops to one drug, it's not uncommon for resistance to develop to other drugs. And just very briefly, this is because of a portion of the pseudomonal AMPC enzymes, which are called pseudomonas-derived cephalosporinases, or you might see that acronym PDC. It's because of a single amino acid change that occurs in the active site of this enzyme, which basically allows the entrapment of these bulky cephalosporins, enabling them to be hydrolyzed by these pseudomonal AMPC enzymes. So very briefly, what about imipenem-relibactam? It's not very clear what the mechanism of resistance is. There's a variety. For example, loss of porins. Remember I mentioned OPRD allows entry of carbapenems. There may be changes to PBP2. Remember, if you recall, PBP3 is the target for cefiderocol as well as other cephalosporins. PBP2 is the target for imipenem. And even though I mentioned that efflux pumps, when they're overexpressed, don't pump out imipenem, they do pump out relibactam. So it's usually a combination of these different types of mechanisms of resistance. And unfortunately, it seems from the data we have so far that about a quarter of the time when you have a patient with a DTR pseudomonas treated with imipenem-relibactam, that the next time pseudomonas is identified, the organism will no longer be susceptible to this agent. Finally, for cefiderocol, it seems that resistance occurs about 15% of the time during treatment with this drug. And there's a variety of mechanisms involved. The most common one is mutations in the iron transport system, which makes sense because this is the system that this antibiotic uses to enter bacteria. So again, for which of these antibiotics is most likely to be active against Pseudomonas, cefiderocol wins? Which of these is associated with optimal patient outcomes? Any of the beta-lactamase inhibitors, as long as they're active, they test susceptible, are likely to have similar outcomes. And which of these agents is most likely to stay active the next time the patient has Pseudomonas infection? Cefiderocol wins. And this is just a rough estimation of how likely it is that emergence of resistance will occur when you're using one of these agents for treatment. And the reason these percentages are different is the denominator here is out of any patient who received the antibiotic and not just the subsequent infections. Okay, so back to our patient. Surprisingly, none of the beta-lactamase inhibitors were active. The only active agent was cefiderocol. And the reason was his isolate was producing a carbapenemase enzyme called AVIM. AVIM is a metallo-beta-lactamase enzyme. You might have heard of NDMs or New Delhi metallo-beta-lactamases being produced from Enterobacterales. And VIM is another type of metallo-beta-lactamase, more commonly produced by Pseudomonas. Now, fortunately, metallo-beta-lactamase enzymes like VIMs are relatively rare in the United States, but you may recall a few years ago, there was a large national outbreak of Pseudomonas contaminating artificial eye drops. And the reason mortality and really poor outcomes like enucleation were so common with that outbreak was because the Pseudomonas was producing VIM enzymes. Now, for VIM-producing Pseudomonas, the only drug that's active is cefiderocol. So if you ever have a Pseudomonas that's resistant to all the beta-lactamase inhibitors, there is a chance it's producing a VIM enzyme. And many of our newer multiplex assays we use in our micro labs For blood cultures like Verogen, GenMark, the Eplex GenMark, or BioFire, do detect VIM enzymes. So for Pseudomonas, I just want to mention that I think there's pros and cons for all four of the drugs that are currently available for DTR Pseudomonas. I think that it's a good idea to test all four drugs because it's not always clear which drug will be active. And certainly the next time the patient has a Pseudomonas infection, I would suggest retesting. And if you believe you have a VIM-producing Pseudomonas, sulfitoricol is the preferred treatment. Now, fortunately, in the calendar year 2026, we're expecting to have a few new drugs available against DTR Pseudomonas. These won't come up on your board exam, but for our clinical practice, this is definitely very exciting. So I'll move on to carbapenem-resistant Acinetobacter infections, or CRAB. And this is another clinical case. A 42-year-old woman with a VP shunt dependency for congenital hydrocephalus had her shunt removed electively, and after an external ventricular drain was placed, she developed fevers, headache, ill appearance, and the CSF was growing CRAB. And you could see here that for the drugs that are typically tested against Acinetobacter, none of these were susceptible. Now, when we think of Acinetobacter in general, the drug we like most to use is something sulbactam-based. Now, there's many benefits of sulbactam. Even though we often think of ampicillin sulbactam, we assume sulbactam is a beta-lactamase inhibitor, sulbactam is very structurally similar to penicillin and really functions more like a beta-lactam when we're talking about Acinetobacter. It has the ability to saturate multiple penicillin-binding proteins, including PBP1A, 1B, and 3 of Acinetobacter. And it's been shown to have unique activity against Acinetobacter through in vitro studies, animal models, and clinical outcomes data. So here's an example of a hollow fiber infection model where the y-axis looks at bacterial growth, the x-axis looks at time. And this is a CRAB isolate resistant to meropenem, polymyxin B, and ampicillin sulbactam. And for polymyxin B, meropenem control, you could see that the bacteria, the CRAB, has no problem growing. But in the presence of high-dose ampicillin sulbactam, even though a large inoculum of bacteria was used, 10 to the 8th, we usually say more than 10 to the 5th is a high inoculum. You could see that even with this high inoculum infection, ampsulbactam, because of the sulbactam, was able to suppress growth of the bacteria. Now, I know this is a very busy slide, but what I wanted to highlight here is each of these blue boxes represents a clinical trial that included patients with CRAB infections randomized to two different treatment regimens. And red, the numbers in red are the mortality in these studies. And what I hope you can appreciate, for all of these studies in yellow, they included sulbactam in one of the arms. And you could see that even if these results were not statistically significant in all of these studies, the arm with sulbactam had improved patient outcomes, lower mortality. So luckily, we now have a new drug called sulbactam durlobactam that became available a few years ago. And basically the way this works is sulbactam functions as a beta-lactam, durlobactam as a beta-lactamase inhibitor, and it inhibits multiple classes of beta-lactamases, but most importantly, OXA classes, which are class D carbapenemases. And this is important because more than 90%, probably more than 95% of CRAB isolates in the United States produce OXA enzymes. One note I want to make, which really isn't relevant, very relevant right now, at least in the United States, is that durlobactam doesn't inhibit class B or metallobeta-lactamases, which are a problem in many parts of the world. But fortunately, in the United States, it's still very unusual for a CRAB isolate to produce a class B metallobeta-lactamase. If it does, unfortunately, the drug won't, the organism won't be susceptible to sulbactam durlobactam. But I do want to mention, because those enzymes are so rare, clinically speaking, if you had a patient with a CRAB, I wouldn't wait. I would test susceptibility for sulbactam-durlobactam, but I wouldn't wait for sulbactam-durlobactam to consider prescribing it for a critically ill patient because it's highly, highly likely to be active. So this is the clinical trial that led to the approval of sulbactam-durlobactam. Basically, it included patients with Acinetobacter, pneumonia, or bloodstream infections randomized to sulbactam-durlobactam plus imipenem versus colistin plus imipenem. And imipenem was added simply because often people, particularly with pneumonia, may have other organisms present like Staph aureus, Pseudomonas, and in this case, patients were enrolled prior to knowledge that they would be growing Acinetobacter. And what you see here is sulbactam-durlobactam 28-day all-cause mortality was about 19% versus about 32% with colistin. Even though this technically was not statistically significant, it is very encouraging news that sulbactam-durlobactam seems to lower mortality quite nicely. And this 19% is a lot lower than that busy slide I showed you with the yellow boxes when you look at the mortality across other treatment regimens in other clinical trials. So one question that comes up is, do we need to add the carbapenem, like the imipenem or meropenem? Can we use sulbactam-durlobactam alone? It seems from in vitro studies, the addition of a carbapenem does lower the MIC for sulbactam 1 to 2-fold, but we don't know if this is very clinically relevant. And the thought here is that durlobactam as a beta-lactamase inhibitor is binding to these oxocarbapenemases and allowing both the carbapenem and sulbactam to bind to penicillin-binding proteins, and they have separate PBP targets. But what I want to show you here, again, the y-axis is bacterial growth, x-axis is time. This is a hollow fiber infection model. You could see what happens to CRAB in the setting of growth control sulbactam. In the setting of sulbactam with durlobactam, it definitely works for some time, but we see regrowth. But then in the bottom there, in the setting of the carbapenem, we really see the most pronounced bacterial killing. So the recommendation from the IDSA guidance is that if you're using sulbactam-durlobactam for a patient with an invasive CRAB infection, that a carbapenem also be administered. Now, what about sulfitoricol? This is another drug that has activity against CRAB, but unfortunately, in a subgroup analysis of a clinical trial looking at CRAB infections, you could see that mortality was almost 50% in the sulfitoricol arm versus almost 20% in the colistin arm. And as I've discussed already, colistin is not a favored antibiotic, so these results are, of course, alarming. So back to our clinical case. This is what this is the woman with the ventricular peritoneal shunt infection from CRAB. Her isolate was susceptible to both sulfitoricol and sulbactam-durlobactam. She was initially started on sulfitoricol and high-dose amsulbactam. This is prior to the availability of sulbactam-durlobactam. We fortunately were able to receive sulbactam-durlobactam as compassionate use, and the patient did very well with this regimen. And pretty remarkably, on the high-dose amsulbactam sulfitoricol regimen, she had persistently positive CSF cultures that cleared immediately with this new regimen. So for CRAB, one point I didn't highlight that, of course, is very important in our clinical practice is just because it grows from a specimen doesn't mean it's causing an infection. So we need to think hard. Do we need to treat this or could this be just colonization? That sometimes can be challenging because these are often very ill patients. But if we're treating a CRAB infection, the preferred choice is sulbactam-durlobactam with the carbapenem. The alternative option is high-dose amsulbactam with a second agent. And this is really because the sulbactam is here alone. It's likely to be hydrolyzed by the oxacarbapenemases. It's not that we have clinical data saying combination therapy is better, but the thought is by having at least two agents on board, there may be some activity between them. So finally, I'll end with Stenotrophomonas multifilia. This is another pediatric case. This is a baby I took care of several years ago with a congenital cardiac defect called transposition of the great arteries. She underwent an arterial switch operation on day 5, which is the typical surgery that happens for these babies. Unfortunately, she had complications and is awaiting cardiac transplant. In the meantime, she developed a persistent stenotrophomonas bacteremia. And what you see here with these positive signs in this figure are all her positive blood cultures for stenotrophomonas. Initially, before we knew it was stenotrophomonas, she was started on a carbapenem because she was quite ill, transitioned to trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, but she stayed positive despite best attempts at source control. Obviously, source control is always limited in patients with ECMO dependency. But then we changed her treatment to sulfitricol, and she no longer had positive blood cultures. So just as a brief overview of stenotrophomonas, it's present extensively in the environment. It's an opportunistic pathogen that colonizes or infects vulnerable hosts with underlying dysbiosis like cystic fibrosis or ICU patients. It can cause hemorrhagic pneumonia in people with hematologic malignancies. And this is the population, for example, patients with leukemia, where we're most worried about this organism. Mortality in these patients is over 80%. And each additional day of carbapenems, which are commonly administered to patients with underlying hematologic malignancies, increases the risk of stenotrophomonas by about 17%. So just thinking hard about, do we really need to give carbapenems or can we reduce the duration for these patients? Because it would also reduce the risk of stenotrophomonas infection. So I'll start with discussing Trimsulfa or trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, which for many of us was the cornerstone of therapy. It still remains active against large percentages of stenotrophomonas isolates, about 90%. We really have no clinical trials investigating its role for stenotrophomonas, so we're sort of stuck with observational studies, but there's a lot of limitations to these studies. There's small sample sizes, there's heterogeneity of sources of infection. It's unclear if the patient has colonization or infection. MIC data are often missing. There's often delays in initiating active therapy as there was with the baby I mentioned. So we're really left deriving the efficacy of Trimsulfa against steno from pharmacokinetic, pharmacodynamic, and animal models. So just to give you an example of one of these, this is a hollow fiber infection model. Again, y-axis is bacterial growth, x-axis is time. And this is using Trimsulfa doses, human doses equivalent to 20 mg per kg per day. So very high doses. And what you see here is in the purple and black, so the trimethoprim MIC here is very low. In purple and black, you see that there's growth of bacteria, no problem. But more importantly, in green is E. coli, you could see that the trimethoprim sulfa at this large dose has no problem killing E. coli. But for steno, at most, with these low MICs, we see stasis, right? We see a horizontal red line. Same is true for 1, same is true for 2. And now when we get to above the breakpoint, so the isolate's no longer susceptible, you could see both E. coli and stenotrophomonas regrew. So basically what this says is that even with very high doses of Trimsulfa and very low MICs of trimethoprim, that we have difficulty with Trimsulfa. We're unable to kill stenotrophomonas, and at most we can cause stasis. And I just wanted to point out a few other examples from other groups that basically show the same results. So can combination therapy help? Well, maybe. At least in vitro, it seems that when Trimsulfa is combined with drugs like levofloxacin, minocycline, that we do start to see some killing. Obviously, this would be great if we could have clinical data to support this. But unfortunately, it has been quite hard to decipher this based on the available clinical data we have because of all the limitations I mentioned with the observational studies. And I just want to sort of highlight this one slide further. Looking at doses of Trimsulfa we typically give comparing E. coli and steno, once again, you could see that maybe at a very low MIC, a MIC of 0.5, we achieve stasis. But beyond that MIC, even in the susceptible range, stasis is challenging to achieve, and killing is nearly impossible. Another drug I want to talk about is sifidricol. So just to orient you here, this was a rabbit model. It includes 8 rabbits who received no antibiotics, and all these rabbits had stenotrophomonas in their lungs. They're neutropenic. In black is no antibiotics, and basically the y-axis here is survival. And what you see is that all 8 rabbits that received the control or no antibiotic died. In blue is Trimsulfa. Only a quarter of them survived. So most of these rabbits died. And for sifidricol, survival was close to 90%. So this speaks to both highlighting or really reinforcing what we just saw, that trimethoprim-sulfa unfortunately doesn't do the job we would like with stenotrophomonas, at least in these animal models and based on PK/PD. But sifidricol seems quite promising. Now, the challenge with sifidricol is we don't have a lot of clinical data. From the clinical trial that included stenotrophomonas infections and included sifidricol, unfortunately, all 5 patients were in the stenotrophomonas arm, and 4 of the 5 did not survive. So obviously, the clinical data here is not very promising. However, there have been quite a large number of clinical case reports that have been reported, as well as several other animal studies that consistently have shown favorable outcomes. So we don't have overwhelming evidence saying sifidricol is a great choice for stenotrophomonas, but it seems like there's generally a signal that's positive from the in vitro PK/PD animal data and case reports that seem to be promising. What about Aztreonam avibactam? This is an antibiotic that became available recently. And the reason this would work against stenotrophomonas is quite interesting, actually. So stenotrophomonas produces a metallo-beta-lactamase enzyme intrinsically. Just like we see with NDMs or VIM enzymes, it has its own metallo-beta-lactamase that it always produces. Now, the problem with this enzyme is this metallo-beta-lactamase is it hydrolyzes lots of beta-lactams, except for Aztreonam. And the reason is Aztreonam is quite small. It fits in the pocket of this enzyme, but doesn't get hydrolyzed because it's so small and doesn't have the right points of contact with the enzyme. So that's great. The problem is stenotrophomonas also produces a type of cephalosporinase enzyme. And what this enzyme does is it hydrolyzes Aztreonam. But the good news is avibactam can find this enzyme, bind to it, inhibit it, and allow Aztreonam to hit its penicillin-binding protein target. So this drug is intriguing. It's considered one of the options for the treatment of stenotrophomonas in the IDSA guidance. In terms of clinical data, from surveillance studies, it seems to be active against about 90% of stenotrophomonas isolates. When we see resistance, it's because of a variety of methods. I included them here, even though this is not something that will come up on the board exam. Unfortunately, we have very little clinical data using Aztreonam avibactam for stenotrophomonas infections. So we definitely need more clinical data, which I believe will come since this drug was more recently introduced. However, we often try to mimic this activity with the combination of ceftazidime, avibactam, and Aztreonam. And we have quite a few case reports with that combination, which suggest successful outcomes. Now, of course, all case reports are prone to publication bias. We tend to publish our positive experiences, but still promising data. So I'll end with 2 other drugs we think about for stenotrophomonas, the first being minocycline. Minocycline's breakpoint against stenotrophomonas is 1 microgram per ml. At an MIC of 1, we expect minocycline to be active against about a third to very high percentages of stenotrophomonas, depending on where you're practicing. So we definitely want to see susceptibility results to confirm susceptibility. And if we see resistance, this is true for all tetracycline derivatives. It's usually because of overactivity of efflux pumps. Now, what I want to highlight here is what we call a Monte Carlo simulation. The y-axis is probability of target attainment. And this basically means how likely are we with the various MICs listed at the bottom to achieve appropriate stasis or sidal activity. What I want to just point out is y-axis is probability of target attainment, x-axis is MIC. This dotted vertical line is where the breakpoint is, 1. And what you can see here is with a very good dose of minocycline in blue, at the breakpoint, we have a pretty good chance of hitting stasis. So that basically means we prevent the bacteria from growing further. So that's good. But for sidal activity, this only happens about half the time. So it's not very good at killing Stenotrophomonas. You could argue, though, these data look a lot better than what we saw with trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. And for levofloxacin, the breakpoint is 2. At this breakpoint, we expect it to be active against 80% of Stenotrophomonas. When we see resistance, it's usually because of an overexpression of efflux pumps, as well as some target changes. I don't think you would need this information for the boards. This is just for your informational purposes. But I think one of the big concerns with levofloxacin from observational studies is it seems that when someone has a Stenotrophomonas infection, is being treated with this agent, about 20 to 50% of the time, resistance seems to emerge. And again, this is another one of those Monte Carlo simulations. Again, the dotted black line is where the breakpoint is at 2. Y-axis is probability of target attainment. And what's concerning here is that the likelihood of stasis is low at this breakpoint, about 50%, and the likelihood of sidal activity is also very low. So again, not very exciting data with levofloxacin. So to summarize for Stenotrophomonas, just like is the case with Acinetobacter, and truthfully the case with Pseudomonas, we always want to think hard about, is this truly an infection or maybe is this colonization and we don't need to treat? The one exception would be people with hematologic malignancies where we want to take these infections seriously. And for severe infections, the preferred treatment is sulfuricol. Hopefully I've convinced you, at least from in vitro animal data, why this is the case. But for non-severe infections, options include aztreonam, avibactam, trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, minocycline, levofloxacin, and it's usually suggested, at least initially, that combinations of these drugs be used, as we don't have overwhelmingly positive data with any one of these drugs. With aztreonam, avibactam, I'll put a little bit of an asterisk. The current IDSA guidance suggests it can be used alone. However, we probably need some more clinical data before we could say that with confidence. So with that, I'll end. I thank you very much for your attention, and I hope to run into you in the ID board review course. Thanks.